Hi, you're listening to Chicago Magazine Chefs on the Grill.
4, 3, 2.
One more time.
Hey there, I'm Mike Nagert, and welcome back to the second edition of Chicago Magazine Chefs on the Grill podcast. All of our interviews with Chicago chefs and food personalities are available for download at chicagomag.com. Chefs on the Grill is a collaboration with Hungry Magazine, which you can find at www.hungrymag.com. This month, we sit down with Rick Tramonto, the executive chef and mind behind True Restaurant. Tramonto, along with his longtime collaborator Gail Gann, has been redefining gourmet cuisine with an artistic touch of whimsy. Tramonto has authored many cookbooks, including True, Amuse Bouche, and American Brasserie. He's also spent some time on the Today Show, Oprah, and most recently, Food Network's Iron Chef. Tramonto is about to open 4 new restaurants this fall in Wheeling, Illinois, at the Westin Chicago North Shore Hotel, including Tramonto Steak and Seafood, RT Lounge, Osteria di Tramonto, and Gail's Coffee Bar. In this interview, we talk about the new projects, competing on Iron Chef, his spirituality, the pitfalls of the kitchen, including his early drug addiction and his divorce from Gand, his influences, and how he developed a signature style. Enjoy the interview.
I know you started out cooking at Wendy's when you were 16. You've been in the world of cooking for quite a long time now.
Yeah, my whole life. My dad went to prison when I was 16 and grew up in upstate New York and needed a job, you know, and never was in the ninth grade. My mom worked at a city school district as a cleaning lady and lunchroom lady during the day kind of thing, and Italian middle-class neighborhood. And when my dad went to jail, I quit school and started to work and got a job at Wendy's. And, you know, back then there was no celebrity chefs in 1978. You know, it was just like, you know, maybe there was Julia Child and the Galloping Gourmet and stuff. But, you know, for me, it was like I could be a garbage man. I could work at a gas station. I could work at a restaurant. And my family, both of them being Italian, I understood food and I was very comfortable with food. So it made sense. So I did that for, you know, a couple of years, and then wanted to make more money. So the place that you would go to make more money would be a place that would sell alcohol. So it was a steakhouse. So I went to the Scotch and Sirloin Steakhouse, and then I went to a place called the Strath Allen, which was kind of like an upscale hotel. And then I left. I met Gail there, and that's when we hooked up, and we went to Manhattan, and we moved to New York and lived through about 6 years of the 80s and survived that. And that's where I developed my drug habit. And then came back and did rehab and got cleaned up. And then had the opportunity to go to London. So we moved to London for 4 years. And then Gail's mom had passed away. So we moved back to Chicago. That's when we actually relocated. And all her family was here. And we got married and just kind of started to work with Rich Melman at Avanzari. It was kind of like in 89. Had a great opportunity to do a little restaurant in Evanston called Trio. And then me and Gail and Henry opened up Trio. Did that for 3 years and went and did Brasserie Tea for another 5. And then Rich said, you know, I love what you guys were doing at Trio. And if you'd like to take it to the city, let's do something big in the city. And space came available. So 7 years at True, going on 8 years at True. 7 cookbooks later, and Gail's got her show on the Food Network, and now we've started this Cenotari project, which is was really a blessing for us through Rich of just kind of introducing us to Mid-America Development Company, who's partners with Starwood Hotels, and they own all the Westins and the W's and the La Meridians and the St. Regis Hotels, and said, look, we love what you guys do at True. We love all your style. We've followed you for many years. Would you consider developing some concepts for us? You know, I was hired as a culinary director for Cenotari, executive chef culinary director, but still remain executive chef partner at True and Osteria Viestato. So my partners there are Rich Melman, and my partners here are Mid-America Development Company and Starwood Hotels. And our first project is out here in Wheeling, which is this luxury Westin that they're building, 410 bedrooms. Mm-hmm. And we're putting our first 4 concepts all in this one hotel. We're doing a Gail's Coffee Bar, which is like a grab-and-go kind of thing, like a Starbucks kind of thing, but it's Ely coffee, and it'll be sandwiches and all Gail's pastries and stuff. And then I'm doing Osteria di Tramonto, which is a version of the Osteria that I did downtown, but the one we did downtown was more of a prefix kind of thing where you come in and you just kind of food comes to you. This is because it's in a hotel, it's more a la carte, and it's breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and room service, which was kind of interesting for me because I love doing breakfast, and I never get a chance to do breakfast, so I got the opportunity to do an Italian slanted breakfast. And those two open October the 12th. And then a month later, on the other side of the hotel, we're opening up Tremonto's Steak and Seafood, which is a contemporary steakhouse. And then the RT Lounge, which is kind of like a crudo oyster bar, kind of fun with some sushi and stuff like that, very Asian. So it's a steakhouse, a little Asian thing, a little Italian thing, and a little... little Gail's thing.
You know, I'm actually, my wife and I are expecting in March. Thank you.
Cool.
And, you know, as somebody who's passionate about food, I think a little bit about, like, the next generation and how do you teach your children about food consciousness and how to eat. You know, I'm curious, are your kids, are they true chef's kids or they're just regular kids? Yeah. They eat whatever, you know?
Well, Gio, who's mine and Gail's son, and Gail and my... Me and Gail have both split and remarried and I have two stepboys with my new wife, and Gail just had two baby girls with her new husband. So Gio, who gets it from both ends, I mean, he's with Gail half the time and me half the time, he's definitely on his way to possibly being a chef. I mean, he travels a lot. He's actually, they left today, him and Gail left today to go to Costa Rica.
Oh, cool.
To visit some coffee plantations and some sugar plantations, which I thought was very cool, and to go to the rainforest and stuff like that. But Gio travels with us a lot. He's exposed to a ton of food. He's exposed and always has been exposed to, farms and ingredients and farmers markets. My two stepboys, you know, they're into good food because I cook good food at home and I educate them and I take them to the farmer's market and I show them stuff. But at the end of the day, they're all about, you know, burgers and fries.
Sure.
And, you know, just food, you know, kid stuff, you know. But yeah, Gio definitely has some of the restaurant bug inside of him, no doubt.
Yeah. Since we're still talking about this, I know you've probably been asked this a lot. But it's interesting because I took an entrepreneurial class at DePaul about a year ago, and one of the things they always talk about is how partnerships are sometimes poison pills, or how they can be worse than a divorce.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is you've gone the opposite route. You've preserved your partnership. You know, you guys had a marriage divorce.
Me and Gail have, I've known Gail since I was 17 years old. So for me, she's been one of my best friends, closest confidants for my life. And when you work together in synergy the way we do for 20 years, I mean, we were married for 12, we've worked together for 20, this industry can swallow your marriage up, you know, let alone being married and doing it together. Most divorces aren't even that. Most divorces in our industry, I mean, we have one of the highest divorce rates, alcohol rates, suicide rates. I mean, the industry's, it's very excessive. It's very, you're able to get access to lots of things. But I think with me and Gail, the biggest thing was that, you know, we loved each other. We were best friends. We just couldn't stay married together anymore. And we knew we built this empire together 50-50. You know, I can't do what Gail does. Gail can't do what I do. You know, we have very different, even though we do the same thing, we have very specific tasks in our day-to-day operations. You know, we really appreciate each other. We respect each other, and we are good at what we do together. You know, what's outside of the kitchen is a whole different arena, but you put us in a situation of cuisine, and we click. I mean, because we grew up in the industry together. I guess it's like musicians or dancers or, you know, basketball players or whatever. I mean, if you play with somebody in a rock band for so long, you know, I mean, you could pick up that guitar and step into a room anywhere, anytime, and start jamming with them, you know.
It's like Mick and Keith.
Absolutely.
You guys are the culinary Mick and Keith.
Absolutely.
Does she have an influence on your savory cooking, I wonder?
You know, she has a stylistic... because Gail had 8 years of art school, and she had, you know, she really taught me early on about line and color and cleanliness and just different contemporary plating styles based on her artwork. And then she started to change mediums from, she was a metalsmith and a glass blower and a painter, and she just turned it over into pastry, basically. Mm-hmm. And as she was transitioning that medium, you know, I was growing up in the industry trying to develop my cuisine, and I watched that happen. So I was able to come along for that ride and understand it. And vice versa, I think she's been able to, because she's not really technically taught in a lot of savory stuff like foie gras terrines or things like that, you know. I think she, again, has seen now what I've taken it, and together it works great, you know.
Going to the art school thing, I think I read that Salvador Dali and Monet were influences for you, which probably doesn't come as a surprise for me. You look at your cuisine. I wonder, what do you take from those guys? You know, what do you love about that?
The open expression. I mean, to go into a gallery, especially, you know, when they're doing a full exhibit of these guys, and you get to grab the body of their work, and you sit there, and, you know, even if, I just remember one day sitting for hours in front of the Monet lily pond, and it was the triptych of the Monet lily pond, and you go up close, and it's like, you realize, you can't see it, and you walk away, and it, you know, becomes life. Just the freedom of thinking that those guys had, and the imagination, and letting themselves not be dictated about what it should be. It's kind of like this. It's kind of like people ask me, do you miss going to culinary school? And I say, you know what? I'm really glad in lots of ways I didn't go to culinary school, because I don't have that teacher in my head, mm-hmm. like, you know, inhibiting me. I can really, truly think out of the box because I know the technical skill, and I've learned and has been taught in the field the technical skill. But as far as the creative part, you're able to let your mind open up and just be free when it comes to that stuff, and not have it be dictated by a mentor, mm-hmm. you know, of any way. I think those guys had that. I think they had that freedom of...
Yeah, you don't have to unbreak bad habits either.
Right.
You know, I was talking to Ben Roche at Modo, and he was saying how, you know, he did a little bit of traditional pastry in culinary school, but he had no idea what he was doing at Modo. It's completely different. It's
right.
good because he doesn't have to think about, well, this is how you make a bread pudding. No. You know what? I'm going to throw it in and do it sous vide, you know, because
very cool.
I don't know. You know?
That's right. Let's see what happens.
you know,
that's freedom, though. I mean, that to me is the magic of, if you really can kind of dissect some of the great chefs in the world right now, that is really the magic.
Yeah.
Right? You said it right there, man.
And, you know, to go to that idea, you know, I was thinking about how you have been a mentor to a lot of folks. And, you know, I the ones I was thinking of, I know Sean McClain worked for you. I know mm-hmm. Graham Elliott Bowles worked mm-hmm. for you. Graham is kind of looped into that molecular gastronomy. I don't know that he's doing that completely. Of course, he uses, you know, like Pop Rocks and things like that. But I think what's really interesting about you is, you know, you were kind of the first guy who really brought culinary food films to America, or at least to the forefront, you know. One of my favorite cookbooks of yours is your Amuse Bouche cookbook, which I think is actually a really good document of how you do culinary films, one of the best ones out there. And that's where I learned to do them, not that I do them all the time. But, you know, what's the line for you? I mean, I'm guessing you're not using a lot of liquid nitrogen and lasers in your kitchen, you know, but you've always been a guy who's been willing to push the edge. You know, what's that line for you?
I think now for me, it's keeping up with the technology and understanding it and understanding application. But again, I go back to my spirit and letting my spirit dictate when to apply that. It's kind of like guys that, you know, that they know how to do foams, but there's foams on every single dish, and it's just overused because it's more of a gimmick to them, or it's not a true application of you know, it really works here and it's balanced, and it's that kind of thing. And to see, you know, to see like Elliot and Grant and Moto and those guys, I love the fact that they're letting their spirit take them in this new journey of theirs. And that's their gig, that's their thing, and that's what man, it's like the bands in the 80s, you know? I mean, there are these hair bands in the 80s, and they, you know, they did their thing, and then there was the punk rock thing, and, you know, you can kind of try to retrofit it, but those guys are growing up in the moment. Those guys are totally growing up in the moment of the cuisine that's going on right now. I grew up in the generation before that. So for me, I want to learn how to play that music, and I want to understand it, but it's not really the music that I play.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
that
makes
sense.
Right, you know, I mean, think of Eric Clapton. I mean, I think Eric Clapton's like this genius guitar player, love his stuff, and I'm sure he keeps up on all the new stuff that's coming, but he's not going to change who he is, or he may use pieces of it in some of his pieces, but he's not going to reinvent himself like maybe a Madonna would do a whole revamp, and she'd come out a whole new person, right, over and over and over again. That's not me. I mean, I want to try to stay true to who I am, what my spirit, what feeds my juices every day, you know, as far as food goes. And I'm intrigued, I'm impressed, I'm blown away by what those guys do. And it keeps me on my toes to keep learning the technology and to try to apply it where it makes sense in my food, but not to say, hey, I'm going to throw what I've learned over 28 years away and now jump on this thing. Mm-hmm. Because that's their thing. It's their moment. It's their time. And no, you know what? And nobody's going to do it better than those guys are going to do it, because it's their generation. Mm-hmm. That's their thing.
I like that perspective, because as you say this, I start thinking about, well, like, is Paul Bocuse going to go and put a goldfish in his plate, you know?
Absolutely
or is he going to have a caviar staircase? Yeah. You know, probably not,
no.
But that's okay.
Yeah.
Because he's the father of Nouvelle Cuisine.
No, but he walked through my kitchen in year three and was blown away by it all. You know, he loved it, you know, and but I'm sure he didn't run back to Lyon and start doing that. Exactly.
Speaking of the caviar staircase, that's kind of your iconic piece. You know, it's really cool. I wondered about the genesis of that idea. And like,
you know, it started at Trio, actually. We had no money at Trio. I mean, we had like $300,000 to open up that restaurant, and we had nothing. It was like having your first apartment. You did all, you know, you came in, you cleaned the place by yourself, you got some paint at Home Depot, and you painted it, and, you know, you just tried to do everything just to get open and be able to have enough money to sustain yourself to get open. And I remember it was the day we were going to open, or the day before we were going to open. I wanted to do a caviar service as part of one of my degustations. And it was like, man, I can't think of what to use, and I don't want it to be traditional. So I just took a walk. And, you know, Evanston is really cool because it's you know, it has all those little art shops in town. And I was just walking through Evanston, in the town of Evanston, down Davis Street, and I just kind of walked past a little art supply store, and there was a caviar palette. I mean, there was a palette that had paint on it, and it just clicked. That would make a cool caviar presentation. So I don't know how back you remember my food, but my first caviar journey was with a palette. It was a caviar palette. If you go back and look at all the old Trio stuff that I did, it was literally a palette that had daubs of caviar on it with creme fraiche. When we left and we went to go do Brasserie Tea, it was like a 5-year, you know, break from fine dining to do more casual stuff. Then when we re-entered fine dining, it was like, okay, I got to bring back the caviar palette. And we kind of said, nah, you know, that we've done that. You know, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? So I like to draw my food. So I sat down and I just started sketching like different caviar presentations and playing with it. And I said, man, I wish I could find a glass guy that could either do like a caviar elevator or a spiral staircase. And I just started drawing all this stuff, and I went and found a glass guy at a place called Glass Artistry in Northbrook, who's an amazing glass guy. And we just sat down, and he came up with these prototypes, and he kept bringing me all these different glass things. And finally we hit the staircase, and it was perfect. I said, that's it. And then he said, you know, why don't we laser your name in it, so not only it's your signature staircase, but your signature's on it. So I you know, I did my signature piece right on it. It was very cool. I mean, it all really organically came together.
Yeah. I know you're a spiritual guy. Oh, you know, and the thing I'm really interested with chefs is, you know, where their influences come from. Mm-hmm. You know, how did they develop their cuisine? I wonder, what kind of impact does that have on your cuisine? Mm-hmm. Does it impact the way you work in the kitchen, the folks that you work with? You know,
it has really changed my life. I just had a meeting with one of my teams today, and I said, you know, it's really important to me that you guys know how to, what my culture is and what my spirit is, and, you know, you're representing me. I said, when you talk to a vendor or you discipline a line cook or you do whatever you do, in the moment, I said, it's going to reflect on me. I said, you guys all know my beliefs. You all know, you know, my my spiritual journey and my belief in Christ and my church and all the things that I do. I said, it's really important to me that you guys represent me properly. I said, I'm not asking you to change who you are. I'm just asking you to respect who I am and to remember that. So for me, what it's done more than anything is it's really opened up the gates for, as we talked about, you know, the industry is very volatile. It's very drug infested, alcohol infested. It's very, you know, lots of adultery, lots of promiscuousness that goes on within the industry. And there's a lot of great chefs that fall. They have families and they've worked so hard to get there, and then they get caught up. They get caught up in their stuff and they blow it, you know, and they either end up starting all over again, or there's a divorce, or there's a drug rehab, whatever it is. And for me, it has a lot less to do with what goes on the plate and a lot more to do with how I walk in the kitchen and how I you know, maintain. I'm, you know, people always ask me, gee, I never see you out. You know, I don't go out. I don't hang out at all the chefs' clubs. I don't go out drinking with all the chefs. That's a protection thing for me. I stay out of all that arena because I know myself, and I know that it's not a healthy place for me to be. I want to go home. I want to spend time with my kids. If I have that kind of time, I want to write another book, or I want to do something else that's going to be more fruitful to my life. You know. So the answer to your question, the biggest thing it's changed, it hasn't changed my food, but it's changed my life, and it's changed how I conduct myself in a kitchen, or how I, you know, how I treat vendors or how I treat people. And now for me, it's about giving back. You know, I so much now want to be in a place where I'd love to be a youth pastor. I mean, I love to cook but I really love the Word of God. And for me, I really want to be able to go to maybe seminary school and really study the Bible and really, really kind of reach out and either I belong to an organization called Angel Tree, and Angel Tree is an association that helps kids that have parents that are in prison. That support wasn't there when I was growing up, and you go and you see these, you know, 5, 6, 8, 10-year-old kids on their birthday or at Christmas time or whatever, and you go visit their parents in prison, and then you go visit the child and say, hey, I was just with your mom. You know, she's really sorry that she missed your birthday, or she's really sorry that she wasn't able to be here at Christmas time. Here's a present from her. And they just like look at you like, you saw my mom? I'm like, yeah, I was just with her last week. And they're like, wow. You know, and then they give you the time of day.
That's cool.
Right? And they sit down with you and you try to help them out. And like, and now I've been so blessed in my life with so many great things and people and family. Now I need God to use me and to help others and to try to give back and to try to, you know, make a difference for me, you know.
When we started this interview, you had mentioned the drug thing. Was that a joke, or was that, did you really have?
Oh, no, I had a drug problem way in the early days, you know, when I was right through New York, through Manhattan, through the, you know, smoked a lot of pot growing up in upstate New York, you know, through that, you know, 16, 17, 18-year-old time. And then when I got to New York, a lot of cocaine, a lot of acid through the 80s, and then did, you know, 4 or 5 months of drug rehab and, you know, totally cleaned up and, you know, never looked back kind of thing, you know.
I think I know your grandfather was Neapolitan, is that right? He's from Naples?
Yeah, my dad's side all came from Naples, and my mom's side all came from Abruzzi.
You know, I would imagine some of the influence of or doing the work with the Osterias, now that you've done with Viestado and now the Tramonto, that's hearkening sort of to some of that influence. Is that, do you ever have this feeling of, like, you know, wanting to take a step back and go, hey, you know what, I just want to open an Italian joint, you know, like a red sauce macaroni factory.
Every Sunday at my house, man. Yeah. So that's what I do at my house.
You guys do a big family meal?
We do,
like, the,
you know,
traditional?
What? We do it a couple times a week. We My wife's a great cook, and we just really, you know, linguine and clams, spaghetti and meatballs. I mean, it's all about Goomba food, we say. Nice. You know? And, you know, and that's what we love to eat. You know, we love pizza, we love pasta, we love all the Italian, you know, classics. And it's great going back into my mother's recipes. Both of my parents have passed, and being an only child, it's like, again, wow, you know, it's like, okay, I'm the only one now. How do I turn some of this over to my kids, you know? So I went and got all my grandmother's recipes from my mother's side and my mom's recipes, and I just finished my latest book. Is called Fantastico, which is an Italian book with Broadway Books, which will be out in 2007. And it's my Italian heritage, and we kind of followed my Italian heritage, but we broke the book up, and there's like a salumi chapter, there's an assaggio chapter, an antipasti chapter, a crudo chapter. It's very Italian, broken down into chapters, but all little plates. But the head notes and the stories really is like a lot of liturgy from both of my parents, mm-hmm. grandfathers, great-grandfathers. So I speak a lot about it in that book. I talk about, you know, the drug years. I talk about, you know, my faith. I talk about the divorce. I talk about a lot of things, and kind of coming full circle now, being the, you know, the happiest I've ever been, being the most grounded I've ever been, you know, being the most financially secure I've ever been. Like, all of it has just been like, wow, you know. It's like, okay, you know, now what?
Yeah. Four new concepts, right? We had talked a little bit about Trio, you had mentioned that, and I know that's kind of where you made your bones here in Chicago. Yeah. And
cool little restaurant, man.
Yeah, it closed this year.
Yeah.
And I wonder what that meant to you. I mean, restaurants close all the time in this business.
Yeah, no, that definitely had a soft spot. And it was cool because Henry brought everybody back, and we had that final Trio Sunday. We did a dinner, and it was everybody that ever was the chef of Trio. It was Sean and Grant and myself and Gail, and it was really quite exciting. And, you know, it's like anything, you know, the evolution of everybody's lives. You know, I looked at Henry, and when I saw his son, I mean, when we opened Trio, I mean, his son was like, you know, 4, you know, and now he's like, you know, in college, you know. It was like, wow, you know. It was like, so like the evolution of life, the circle of life couldn't have been more relevant, because Gail was there with her new husband and her new kids, and I was there with my new wife and all my kids, and Henry was there, you know, and we kind of, and then Sean was there, and he's got 3 restaurants, and right. Grant was there, and like, when you really looked at the room and you looked around, the thing that came to my mind is like, circle of life. I mean, uh-huh. Look at this, you know, and I'm still looking at the floors that we painted the day that we moved in because we didn't have any money, or the crack in the ceiling that we couldn't afford to repair. I mean, all the memories of all those physical things were still there, mm-hmm. but the people that filled the room, you know, were in another time warp, you know. Yeah. It was very cool. And Henry, you know, for me, Henry was still like, wow, you know, I want to still... He still was talking about doing the same thing that he was talking about doing when we first opened, which was, I just want to have a hot dog stand on the beach in Maui, you know? And it was like, Henry, you got to go do the Maui thing, man. You got to go open your hot dog stand in Maui. And that, and Henry's course that night were hot dogs.
Nice.
Like, he did street hot dogs, and he had great buns and was steaming them and, nice. You know, real mustard and, like, the whole nine yards. It was very funny.
That's funny. You know, I was surprised to read, I was looking at your biography, it said that you went to Trotter's in 1989. Is mm-hmm. that true?
Yeah.
What were you trying to do with that?
You know, it was I think it was Charlie's third year open. It was year 3, and it was right before I went to Europe, and I was waiting for a number of things. Actually, I was waiting for my work visas. I was waiting for this job to go through. And I had just finished up with Lettuce and opened up Biche downtown, and I hated it. I worked at Biche for like 4 months and just hated it, and, you know, wasn't really learning anything, and there was no discipline, and it just wasn't for me. And I remember leaving Biche one day and just walking, and literally just walking and thinking and not really paying attention, and literally walked up and found myself in front of Charlie Trotter's restaurant. I went to the back door, I knocked on the back door, I said, hey, you know, I'm Rick Tremonto, I'm the chef over at Biche. I just gave my notice. I need a job. You know, you need any help? And, you know, it was very humbling again, and Charlie wasn't Charlie yet. You know, mm-hmm. it was way before he became big time. And I was a sous chef for like 8 months, you know, and then my visa came through and this job in London came through, and then that's when I left to go do that.
I mean, you're clearly your own guy, but I wonder, is there anything you take out of that experience or something you learned in that short period of time?
You know what? The biggest thing I learned was the nobody that I've ever worked for in my life has ever demanded excellence on a day-to-day, minute-by-minute level as high as Charlie.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, and still is, you know, regardless of what you read in the paper, an amazing inspiration to me and an amazing mentor, not so much in cuisine, mm-hmm. as much as raising the bar. I mean, the guy is just amazing when it comes to being relentless of being excellent, mm-hmm. you know, and every single detail about every single thing. And the one thing that Charlie would always instill into us, our team at that time, that I still always say to my team, and it's funny because, you know, it really truly is one of the sayings that is a Charlie Trotter saying that he stuck in my head. He said, you know, if everybody would just come in this restaurant and do one thing better today than they did yesterday, we would have 50 new things better today every day.
Mm-hmm.
And I just never forgot that saying. And it was just like, yeah, I mean, all I got to do is one thing. If I just polish the silver better today, even though I got to do 100 things as a busboy, if I just do that one thing better today than I did yesterday, and mm-hmm. you're the waiter, and you polish the glasses better, and the cook, you know what I mean? If everything, and it's not too much to ask. Mm-hmm. Just do one thing better today than you did yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I'm asking you to do. And you do that with 30, 40, 50 people in a restaurant,
yeah,
you get Charlie Trotter.
I always thought it was funny how, you know, if you, of course, people always make comparisons between True and Trotters, and I always thought there's the one thing you guys did was you guys gave people like the takeaway for like the next morning,
mm-hmm.
Which I always thought was funny because, you know, it was like this idea that Trotter stopped at like the Mignardis, and then you guys went a step further, and
yeah.
I always liked that detail.
Thank you.
Know?
You.
It was like, that's the step up, you
right.
know.
for us, we've always, you know, I've always been compared to Charlie so much. I said the biggest thing that really is comparison to us is that we just have different. I mean, Charlie's is a very, you know, it's very serious. It's very technically sound. It's very disciplined. It's got all that intensity, all that, you know, and me and Gail were like these kids that were growing up that, you know, we have this saying that, you know, we're fine dining with a sense of humor,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it doesn't make it better or worse. It's just we're different people, right? I mean, is there any difference between a really serious opera that's like has a 50-piece orchestra and nobody laughs and it's really serious and, you know, versus like, you know, the Chili Peppers, who,
sure.
you know, have the best-selling album and, you know, are laughing and having
sure.
a good time on stage, right? It's that kind of thing. I mean, if we can laugh and have fun and still use the best ingredients and still be technically sound and, you know, and still laugh and have a family and wrap our arms around that, I think that's huge.
Yeah, it's whatever inspires you. Speaking of Charlie, that, you know, segues, you think about the foie gras, of course, people made a lot about the flap, that thing.
let me tell you, when we made Newsweek and Time magazine, I had to call Charlie and say, you know, we should have thought of this a lot earlier, bud, because it got so, I've never seen anything get more blown out of proportion.
Yeah, did they just catch him on a bad day, you think?
Or you know what, I just think it was this, I think it was one of those press snowballs.
Uh-huh.
I think it was like, the telephone game. Like one person says, you know, go down the street to the left and it's blue. And, you know, I mean, it starts to exaggerate itself kind of thing. I think it got so exaggerated, but it got so exaggerated so fast within a 48-hour period, it became like this. It made the New York Times,
mm-hmm.
you know, it made the front page of the Chicago. I just, when I woke up that morning and I like opened up my newspaper and I was like, reading the front page of the Chicago Tribune, I just could think to myself, I just said to my wife, I said, boy, man, they must really have nothing to write about today because we're on the front page of this thing, you know?
It's really a commentary on the extent of how big chefs are today in society, you know?
It's amazing.
Maybe too much, but...
Yeah.
what does the Foie Gras band mean to you? Does it mean anything personally to what you're doing at True, or maybe even what you're doing with the new stuff?
Well, the cool thing is that we're out of the city limits, so Tremonto right. Steak and Seafood will have Foie Gras on the menu. Good to say.
Yeah.
True finishes up Foie Gras this week, or last week, I think it was. Last week, I think we finished our last week of Foie Gras. But, you know, as I said to so many journalists that we've talked to about this, I said, you know, the people who really lose here, A, are the consumer and the customer. And I really felt like I wish I could say that the people have spoken, but I don't believe the people have spoken. I believe that government spoke. I believe that lobbyists spoke. I believe that there was a lot of hidden agendas going on. You know, and you had two high-profile chefs that respect each other immensely that just have different opinions that were used, you know, for different activist reasons. But, you know, what are you going to do? I respect the law. I respect, you know, lawmakers. Thank God we live in a country that we live in spite of the world that we live in with all the terrorist stuff and the 9/11 stuff. And, you know, so, I respect that. But I think at the end of the day, there's so much stuff to deal with, especially in Chicago with, you know,
sure.
our schools and, you know, there's so much other stuff that we should be really focusing on. And if we're going to focus on food and food safety, then let's focus on lunchroom, you know, lunches. Let's focus on factory farming that's, you know, screwing everything up. I mean, there's a lot of other really good stuff that has to do with food and that has to do with, you know, than that. It just didn't make sense to me. And the reason why, you know, it's amazing to me, like these huge, huge companies, these huge chicken companies and beef companies, and, you know, nobody would ever think to go after them because there's way too much lobby money and political money behind them that it's like going after the gun controls, right?
Yeah, it's like the new trans fat ban. I don't think that even has a chance. I mean, people like McDonald's, all these, they're so much power again that's going to stand up against them, you know? Which is why they went after foie gras, I guess, because it was an easy target.
Little tiny. And you know what? Those little couple, three, four tiny farms and their family farms that have been around for so long, and those people now, their livelihood's kind of trashed, you know?
Right.
They got to figure out what they're going to do. My other concern was that, you know, where does it stop?
Yeah.
Where do you draw the line? You know, is it lobsters next? Is it veal next? Is it, like, what is next? And how long will we let the line keep being moved, you know?
Yeah. And then I think the most important point is, like you said, it's the values of our legislature. I mean, a good friend of mine, he lives on sort of the edge of gentrification in Chicago, and he's had some problems with some homeless guys who've been smoking crack in his alley, and they broke into his garage and things like that, and he reported it to the alderman and talked about it, but these guys keep doing it and they're not patrolling. And he joked and he said, you know, he's like, I was gonna tell my alderman that the homeless guys were back there grilling up foie gras. And smoking cigarettes and I figured they might do something about it, you know. And it's like, but
touche, man.
Exactly, right? So, you know, you got a lot of new projects. You got four, basically. You know, the thing I wonder about, you know, there's a lot has been made, I think, about Jean-Georges in the last few years about how, you know, he's getting so big and, you know, has the quality of his things, of his enterprises slipped. And, you know, do you worry about that? I mean, how do you, you know, concentrate on something like True while you have this? I know True is Tremonto Unlimited. And
I know
you're not about limits, but.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I was just with Michael Batterbury with Food Arts Magazine in New York last week, and, you know, we kind of had the same conversation, and we both came to the conclusion. I said, have you eaten a Jean-Georges lately? He said, nah, not in a while. I said, you know what? I ate there last night. I said, and it was like one of the best meals I ever had. I said, whatever he's doing with his other projects or whatever, Jean-Georges is his. That's his palace. That's his diamond in the crown. You know. Nobody's ever going to let that. He's never going to take his eye off of that. He may take his eye off of some of this other stuff, but he'll never take his eye off of that. And that's his baby. And that's the way I think me and Gail have always looked at it, is that, you know, True's always been our baby. It'll continue to be our baby. But you know what? At the end of the day, I don't have a crystal ball, and maybe it will slip, or maybe something will happen, or all I know is that, you know, I will do everything in my power to maintain what my integrity is and what my character is. I don't plan on doing 75 restaurants. I don't want to be a Rich Melman or now a John George or an Emerald, or that's not the focus here. I think the focus for me has always been to do, you know, to do great projects with great people and to make sure that the food quality, the wine culture, the service culture is always intact. And we'll see. I mean, I'm only going to grow when I have great people to grow. If I got 8 chefs that are all ready to be chefs, I have a responsibility to say, we need to open up another restaurant because I'm going to lose these guys to John George or to somebody else unless I can keep my stuff going. And then I look at it on a personal level. Look, I've been at the Stoves at True for 7 years, okay? I was at the Stoves at Brasserie T for 5, and I was at the Stoves at Trio for 3. I'm 43. I got 3 boys. You know, where's my growth, mm-hmm. right? Am I going to be at True forever? Probably not. Am I going to be cooking at Tremonto Steakhouse forever? Probably not. You know, I think over the next 10 years, my life now needs to take on the next set of challenges for me personally, whatever that is, cuisine-wise, or opening up restaurants, or books, or television. But as I told you at the beginning of the interview, it also has to be able to come full circle with God. Mm-hmm. And believe me, if I was a self-made millionaire, I probably wouldn't be cooking anymore. I'd probably be helping Angel Tree or my church or doing missions work out in Africa or something like that. Because that's where my heart is. And, you know, my spirit of food and spirit of love and my love for restaurants is always going to be there, just like my love for my kids. But now, you know, I want to balance my life too a little bit and spend some time, you know, with sure. with me.
Sure.
You know?
I mean, I think the big thing is even like a guy like Thomas Keller had to come out of the kitchen. You know, he's per se is his sort of project. And, you know, he's got the China now. And, you know, you got to do that. People are people. You get worn down. You can't be out cleaning out the walk-in. You know, your knees are going to break down at some point.
You know what, though? It's interesting. Again, Thomas Keller is a fantastic example. And so is Danielle. I mean, Thomas Keller has the French Laundry, which is absolutely still impeccable. I ate there last year. And at this last trip, I ate it per se, and it was absolutely impeccable. And he's got 3 Bouchons and the bakery. And I mean, he's, you know, he's got 2 books, 2 more on the way, blah, blah, blah. But, I mean, I still was like, when I went to per se, I was like, oh, my God, look at, I mean, it was so pristine. Okay, what does that tell me? That tells me that he has great disciples behind him. That tells me that he's really still involved. You know, I'm still involved. I'm still writing menus at True. I'm still, you know, there, you know, a couple times a week checking on the food and tasting food and being part of the team and inspiring and disciplining and all that kind of stuff. You know, it's just part of the culture. It's part of the growth, you know. Danielle the same way, man. Danielle's amazing at what he's able to do. You know, and then I look at some of the other guys like a Mario Batali.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what a great 8 or 10 restaurants he's got, mm-hmm. you know, and is able to keep all that food at an amazing level.
And he found the time to give you a good battle and
man,
in Iron Chef.
I'm telling you, man, he whooped me. Whooped me.
How was that? Was that humbling for you a little bit?
You know what? It was a blast. Yeah. We never went in there in any sense of the imagination of like, I mean, Mario cooked it True and did his book tour there. We do a lot of events together. I mean, we're total buds, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just kind of like, you know, we went in there and we just wanted to finish. You know, for us it was like, that's what he does.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he cooks with that same team
yeah.
on that same side of that kitchen 3 times a week. So for him, when he opens up the drawer, he knows the spoon is there. He knows the pan is there. Like, he knew that facility. For us, it was like, man, where's the sheet pan?
Yeah, you know, yeah. Like, I think Gail had a hard time putting the sheet pan.
I mean, that was the biggest challenge. It wasn't the food or the time, and that was all real time. I mean, it was very cool because it was real time. It was no bullshit. It was all the real deal, you know. There was a lot of pre-production stuff, but that 1 hour was that 1 hour. No excuses, you know. The other thing is I did everything I possibly could to show well. I did as high as level of presentation as I knew how to do. I did as many dishes as I had time for. I had time for 7 dishes, so I did 7 dishes. I mean, when I go back and look at the tape, I don't know where I missed it, other than when you look at some of the comments of the one girl thought one of the things needed salt, and
Dana Cowan said your risotto was gummy.
But it was gummy. But you look at that stuff; everything had to sit. I mean, once you're done with the battle, you have to plate up the food, and you have to wait for each judge to taste each set of food. Right. Now, granted, we got to go later on, but still, once the timer goes off and you drop your knife or your spoon, that's it. Anything that's on the stove, that's it. You can't touch it.
Done.
So, yeah, maybe risotto wasn't the smartest choice, I guess, after really analyzing the whole thing. I probably should have picked another dish that would have sat well. But, it was a blast. We had a great time, and it was fun. I mean, I haven't had that much fun in a long time. I mean, me and Stuart, my sous chef, and Gail, we had a great, great time. We had a really great time.
I was surprised your originality scores were. I thought those were like a little low. And it's like, what, you got goldfish swimming around. Nobody does
that. What do you want?
Right?
Right.
I had to go
into Soho and find some little pet store that was open that would like sell me some like little fish. Yeah. I mean, it was tough, man. It was tough scoring. I think our originality was low. Yeah. I mean, but you know what? It is what it is. And for us, it was. I wanted to finish, and I finished, That to me was what I went there to accomplish, to do. It's like, wow, can I really do 5 dishes, 5 of each dish in an hour or whatever? It was like, okay, let's do that.
And you guys, you have a fixed list of potential secret ingredients, right? Like there's like 5 or 6 it could be.
It could be, but, you can't, you walk in there with 5 or 6 menus in your head.
Yeah. Was fennel one that you were happy with, or was it hoping
they had almond was one of them. There was a bunch of them, but almond was very intriguing to me. Cream was very intriguing to me. Fennel was, it was all good, But there were different menus, you kind of thought, well, if it's going to be this, we should do this. So then when you realize what the ingredient is, then again, you go back to the equipment thing. It's like, okay, well, I needed different equipment for my almond menu than I needed for my fennel menu kind of thing. So you're still like, where is the spatula?
Yeah. I'm always interested in chef's tattoos. I noticed you have a couple.
Yeah.
I know this is a visual medium, but I'm curious.
If this is my life scripture, which is I can do all things through Christ which strengthens me, Philippians 4:13. This I got when I was 18 years old. This is something that Gail drew for me. It's kind of like that, the spoon, the fork, the knife, runs away with the plate kind of thing. I got this, I actually just got it touched up. It was grapes, which are a wine and grapes kind of thing. Got another one over here, which is a very old one as well, which is kind of like the whole, I'm a Gemini, I was born in May,
okay.
So it's the good and evil chef kind of thing,
cool.
Of that. I got knives and forks that are all trinkled up that are like bob wire that goes around my ankle and up my leg, and I got a set of knives on my other leg.
Very cool.
Yeah, I love tattoo art, I love Miami Ink, I love watching that show. I think those guys are amazing on what they're able to do with art like that. Just love it.
Yeah, Graham's got a bunch too.
He does.
Talking to him, it was funny. He was telling me. I thought it was one of the people who said the thing that made most sense to me, because people always criticize tattoos, blah blah blah. But he had said that these are the things I loved at that moment, and they may still be who I am, but even if they're not. When I'm an old guy or whatever, I'll look back on it and it'll remind me of who I was.
That's right. That's fabulous.
And I love that.
I love that. It's a great saying. And what I always said, people always said to me, how did you know? I said, I knew 2 things. I knew that I didn't want to have a skull and crossbone my whole life, because I may have been that at the moment, but probably. But for me, I knew I always loved food. So anything food-wise I would ever have gotten would have been always good to the day I died, and anything spiritual I got would be good to the day I died. So I was pretty safe with those 2 things.
I know you had a great meal at Pierre Gagné. I was curious about that meal, what it was that really inspired you, that you loved about it.
You know, there was, and since then there's been five meals, you know, but the first time I ate at Pierre Gagnaire, it was really the first time I was ever, that I ever saw Dali on a plate, or I ever saw, remember we talked about, you know, Monet and Dali, and, you know, it was really the first time I saw, you know, sauce work that was so paintbrush-esque, and, you know, and not just, you know, I worked with Alfred Portali at the Gotham in New York, so I understood high food and architectural food, but just some of the painter's food, if you will, and then the flavor combinations. It was like the first time I was ever seeing, like, coxcomb and chocolate, and, you know, some really interesting, you know, I had to really stretch your mind to go, wow, that does really work, and why does that really work, and why didn't I think of that? and he really is a genius, right? So, yeah, I mean, it was a lot of that kind of stuff.
If you were throwing a dinner party, you know, you can invite anybody alive.
Jesus.
Alive or dead. Jesus.
Oh, okay, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I would love to sit. Can't wait. Can't wait to sit with Jesus and talk to Jesus about life.
What would you cook for Jesus? Assuming,
you know,
he asked
Jesus
you to make
ate
you something.
Jesus ate a lot of fish, so I got to think it would be something fish.
That's awesome. Thanks for doing this.
My pleasure. Anytime.
It was good to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Thank you for listening to Chicago Magazine Chefs on the Grill. We'll see you next month, and in the meantime, stay hungry.